at 11 o'clock. We'll be back with another edition of Sunday Brunch at the Cut to the Chase program with Sylvester Rivers and, of course, your girl, Ife Jai. We appreciate everybody tuning in. Shouts out to Gary for holding us down always, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you so
much. Love you.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Not only are KPFK listeners smart, interesting, and forward-thinking, you're also very generous and deeply appreciated. Thank you so much for pledging your support to KPFK during our fund drive.
LA Theater Works airs here on KPFK every Sunday evening from 10 p.m. until midnight. Coming up tonight,
a young woman in the late 60s struggles to make the best of her newfound liberation.
I've yet to torch lingerie.
We're talking life choices.
I haven't made them yet.
Yes, you have, or we'd be getting married today.
Caitlin Hopkins and Martha Plimpton star in Wendy Wasserstein's Pulitzer Prize-winning comedy, The Heidi Chronicles, next time on LA Theater Works.
That's LA Theater Works, coming up here on KPFK tonight at 10 p.m.
Support comes from the Soraya, presenting the return of the iconoclastic Chicano performance troupe, Culture Clash. On May 4th, their all-new show, May the 40th Be With You, serves up an explosive cocktail of humor and satirical outrage that dares you not to laugh out loud. California natives Richard Montoya, Rick Salinas, and Herbert Siguenza have profoundly explored the evolution of Latinx culture on stages and screens for four decades. More information and tickets at thesoraya.org and kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Sally Kirkland, and you're listening to KPFK, radio powered by the people, fiercely independent, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles.
It's the Ralph Nader Radio Hour.
Stand up, stand up. You've been sitting way too long.
Welcome to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. My name is Steve Scrovan, along with my trusty co-host, David Feldman. Hello, David.
The anti-trusty co-host.
Anti-trusty co-host, especially since what happened with JetBlue and Spirit this week. And also the man of the hour, Ralph Nader. Hello, Ralph.
Hello, everybody.
I hope you've gotten over your birthday hangover. Our first guest today is Professor Barbara McQuaid. Some of you may recognize her from the legal commentary she provides NBC News and MSNBC. She also teaches law at the University of Michigan and has written a book which is climbing the charts. It's entitled Attack from Within: How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. In the book, she defines disinformation as, quote, the deliberate use of lies to manipulate people, whether to extract profit or to advance a political agenda. Its unwitting accomplice, misinformation, is spread by unknowing dupes who repeat lies they believe to be true, unquote. Professor McQuaid chronicles how authoritarians use these techniques to disarm their enemies and rise to power, and how, in this historical moment, the Trump MAGA movement is using the same playbook. Then we turn back to the ongoing genocide in Gaza. For that, we welcome back frequent guest, retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Regular listeners know Colonel Wilkerson as Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff and Special Assistant to General Powell when he was Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's been in the rooms where these types of military and diplomatic decisions have been made and will give us his take on how to interpret what is happening now. And stay tuned, because Colonel Wilkerson is not one to mince words. As always, in between, we will check in with our indefatigable corporate crime reporter, Russell Mokhiber. But first, Ralph has stated many times that empires usually crumble from within. Our first guest has outlined for us the nature of that attack. David?
Barbara McQuaid served as United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan from 2010 to 2017 As part of President Donald Trump's 2017 dismissal of U.S. attorneys, she stepped down in March of 2017. She's a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School, a legal analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. Her latest book is Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. It's published by Seven Stories Press. Welcome to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Barbara McQuaid.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
Thank you very much, Barbara. First, I always like to give authors the opportunity to explain their book before we then start the question process, and I'm going to ask you to do that as well. But before I do, I just want to ask you, why did you use the word disinformation? And I ask that for two reasons. One is, this is a relatively recent word. The word used to be propaganda. And in 1970 Merriam-Webster Dictionary, disinformation isn't even listed. And if you asked an ordinary person or persons, what does disinformation mean to you? What would they say?
Disinformation comes from a world that I'm familiar with, which is in national security. As a prosecutor, I worked in counterintelligence. And as a law professor, I teach a course on national security. And so disinformation is information warfare. It is an effort to use information in a way that is designed to mislead, to deceive, and to manipulate. So in some ways, I suppose it's similar to propaganda, but it is a tradecraft. And in my book, what I hope to do is to educate people about this tradecraft, open their eyes to how it works so that they can build resilience against it and prevent the kind of manipulation it is designed to achieve.
This is an overwhelming book, listeners. It's a jackhammer of documentation about what's happening to the very concept of truth in this country, never mind facts. So can you tell us what you tried to do with this book and describe it in your own words?
Yes, thank you for that opportunity. Well, the goal of the book is to sort of describe what I see happening in our country at the moment, to explain how it is harming our democracy, public safety, and the rule of law, and offer some proposed solutions. And so I intend to make it very accessible to the average reader so that we can try to understand this political moment and get out from under it. My background, as I said, is as a national security prosecutor. So I see this as a threat to our national security. And I think that there are two main drivers of what is happening right now that is causing this onslaught of disinformation. One is technology, which, you know, can be a wonderful tool, the ability to communicate with people around the world about our interests and hobbies and connections is a wonderful thing. But like most technology, like most tools, it can be used as a weapon. And so for those who want to deceive or manipulate people, it has become very easy to take false information and push it online. And what used to take months or years to indoctrinate people can now be done with the push of a button by sending a message that will reach millions of people in just a moment. And so that technology, I think, is really something that is a game changer. I think the other thing that is happening right now is that we are seeing people who are so convinced that their side is right. We are so polarized that they are willing to choose the ends over the means. They care about their vision of America, and therefore they are willing to say whatever it takes to support that vision of America. Some people are deceived by these lies, but many others know the truth and yet push false claims anyway. I think these are people who are choosing tribe over truth. And just to give you an example, there are certainly some people who believe that the 2020 election was stolen. But I think there are plenty of other people in Congress who absolutely know that was not the case and yet will push that claim anyway because they believe it helps them politically. Elise Stefanik, the congresswoman from New York, has begun repeating the phrase Donald Trump uses, which is to refer to defendants who have been convicted and incarcerated for their acts on January 6th as hostages, suggesting that they are political prisoners in some way. She most certainly knows better. Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz, senators who are Ivy League educated lawyers, certainly know how elections are supposed to be counted and certified and know that there was no fraud in the last election. And yet, even after the attack on the Capitol, they voted against certifying the results of that election. So I think that it is that deliberate choice of tribe over truth combined with technology that has put us in a very dangerous place.
Let's dissect this. Do you think, on the whole, that the internet has damaged democracy and truth and factual dialogue more than it's enhanced it?
I don't know. Maybe a little bit of both. You know, we have the ability now, I think, to talk with a lot of other people across differences. I think one of the things that technology and social media has done is it has really changed the way we talk about politics. You know, it used to be said that all politics is local. I think now all politics is national. And I think some of that is because we are talking at a national and even international level with people online about what's happening in our country and our world, instead of talking with our neighbors in person about the garbage pickup and the streetlights. And so I think that that has caused us to disengage from normal civic society and instead, you know, spend our political time reading online, communicating with people online and not in real life. I think there's also been a contributing factor in the demise of local journalism that has made it harder for us to come together as communities and understand what's happening in our communities. And instead, we are left to rely on proxies to tell us what's happening at the national level instead of engaging at the local level. And I think that's to our detriment.
The local journalism point is very crucial in your book, because local journalism has a checkmate of local observation for accuracy. And not only does it generate original content, but it also is more accountable because it's more immediate to the readers. And the readers, in their knowledge of the community, can debunk any false statements. But I'm not asking you about the potential of the internet. I'm saying, as of today, March 2024, since the internet came on board with the funding of the Pentagon to develop it, do you think, on balance, it has damaged democracy in all its...
And about Rush scribes in Google to use numerical operatives have seen how effective it can be and do the same thing. So, for example, some of the things that Robert Mueller cites is accounts that were run by Russian operatives that were set up many, many months before the 2016 election and were designed to develop loyal followers. So they had names like Blacktivist that looked like a Black political activist, or United Muslims of America, or Tennessee GOP, or Heart of Texas, or Coal Miners of America. And all of these looked like they were genuine grassroots Americans, and they said things that most members of those groups would believe in and find non-controversial and that they would support. And so over time, they built large, large followings. And then as it got close to the election, they would say things that were incredibly harmful and damaging, like the Blacktivist account repeated over and over again. Black voters should not go out and vote for Hillary Clinton. She's never done anything for us. She ignores us. And so we should send a strong message that we should not be ignored. You can't ignore our voice and not show up or vote for her on election day.
You're dodging the question. The question is, to date, has the internet been more of a damage to our democracy than it has helped? And my answer is yes. And you know what my basic evidence for that is? It's called the book by Barbara McQuaid called Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. Now, you're making a point that's very important. People are not willing to clean. It's a one part in your book is the cause of a huge defamation, et cetera, to the editor.
My answer to yourself, and I think it is in which it could be abused. And so in 1996, when social media didn't even exist, it was just in its infancy, we passed Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which provided for immunity from legal liability for social media platforms, which probably sounded like a great idea at the time. It probably allowed all of the innovation that we have seen come to roost today, some of which is great. America is a leader in social media platforms. But I think we've reached a point where we see the problems and the collateral consequences, and we need to make some changes. You know, as I say in the book, Ralph, the internet is like, you know, growing a baby alligator in your bathtub. It was adorable when it started and so exciting. And then it grew into a man-eating predator. So we need to change the way we deal with it. And so with regard to anonymity, I think it would be beneficial to prohibit anonymity online for just the reasons you say. People behave horribly when they can be anonymous. People are just mean when they can behave anonymously. I mean, I think about my own behavior. If I'm in the bank or if I'm in the grocery store, I am the model of good behavior. I stand in line obediently and I smile and nod politely to others around me. But put me behind the wheel of a car in traffic where I'm anonymous and unaccountable and I'm an animal, right? I'm cutting people off and I'm waiting to get over in that lane that they say lane closed ahead because I have no accountability. and no one can see me face to face.
Let me amplify that by reading a section in your book on page 145, which I think is one of the most important pages in your book. And it's under a subtitle called The Round Peg in the Town Square. You basically say, anonymity, I'm quoting, anonymity, bots, algorithms, and different social norms make social media platforms completely distinct from a public forum on a street corner. When one considers how badly the metaphor fits, comparing profit-driven social media platforms to public space is itself a kind of disinformation. Anonymity online is one way in which social media are different from the traditional town square. In the town square, we know who's speaking because we can see and hear them. We base our assessment of arguments in part on the credibility of the speaker. In contrast, some social media platforms permit anonymous accounts, allowing anyone to pose as someone else, period, end quote. Because when you look at all the media that the Trumpsters have got, national, state, local, that the election was stolen, there's an asymmetry between the rebuttal of people saying, where's your evidence? The key phrase, where's your evidence? Where's your authority under law? Are dim and indistinct. Let's start with an easy one. On page 84, you basically have a section that says, insult them to death. And basically, you start with a favorite topic of mine, the unrebutted nicknames that Trump has pejoratively given to friends and foes alike who disagree or oppose him. I'll quote, quote, I cannot remember Trump ever publicly telling a conventional joke or engaging in a politician's standard self-deprecating humor. Instead, he mocks his opponent with demeaning nicknames by calling his political rivals names like, quote, Crooked Hillary, quote, Clinton, or, quote, Sleepy Joe Biden, quote, Trump reduces them to negative caricatures, creating false but enduring impressions. Trump jabbed at Senator Elizabeth Warren's claimed Native American heritage by calling her, quote, Pocahontas, unquote. He also relentlessly targeted any member of his own party who dared to challenge him. He called Texas Senator Ted Cruz a rival candidate, quote, lying Ted, end quote. He called his own attorney general, who recused himself from the Trump-Russia investigation, quote, Mr. Magoo, after the cartoon character. So how would you respond, if you were a political consultant, how would you respond to his nicknames and his getting away with it? How would you give him some of his own medicine?
So I'm not a political consultant, and I think what I would love to see is not giving people some of their own medicine, because I think it just escalates until we're all in the sewer calling each other's names. You know, I mentioned in the book how others have taken up this mantle by, you know, local politicians engaging in name calling against their opponents. It is such base and demeaning way of engaging in discourse. What I'd rather see is people call this out and talk about how incredibly inappropriate it is to reduce someone to a nickname instead of focusing on solving real problems. You may have legitimate arguments and concerns about your opponent. Maybe they have been hypocritical in their view on positions. Maybe they have held positions that are not in the best interest of the country. Those are all fair game. But to simply call them names is so juvenile and so damaging to democracy. And I think that's what I would point out is, this person is not a serious person who wants to engage in issues. This person wants to hurl insults and bring all of us down to that level.
Is that happening? Is there a rebuttal at your high level of exchange? Democrats, for example, are they engaging that rebuttal, or is just letting them have free exercise?
I think people are still bewildered about how to respond to Donald Trump. I think the media is bewildered because we've never seen anything like him. He's an absolute disruptor of how our system works. And so he's a big bully who runs around and says all kinds of mean things, and nobody knows how to deal with it. I think the media still struggles to decide, how do you cover someone when we've been trained to give both sides of an argument, which presumes that both sides are engaging in good faith, when instead you have someone who is not engaging in good faith, engaging in lies, making even inconsistent statements. You know, classic example of Donald Trump accusing the FBI of planting evidence in his home, and then later saying he had every right to take those documents. that are now in his home. So not even demanding consistency on the arguments he makes. And so I think the media has been confused. Do you cover his rallies, or are you just giving airtime and oxygen to lies? Or do you not cover his rallies where he can say things that then go unrebutted because people aren't even aware of what he is saying other than his supporters? So I'm not sure I know the answer of how best to cover these things, but I think real-time fact-checking of lies is important. And I think criticizing the use of belittling nicknames is the most effective way to push back again, rather than just calling him a name. Then we're all debased.
I agree with you. You don't want to go down in the mud with people. But when the national press begins and continues to be his bullhorn, verbatim, repeating it, given no right of reply, there's no way you can simply say, I don't want to go to his level, because the press has raised it to a level that is devastating to our democracy and all the things you have in this book. Did you ever think that you're making too strong a case without inserting more of the rebuttals in the text itself? Because I'm worried about people just saying, it's hopeless, it's over. She's made such a case, there's no way we're going to recover. The internet, uber alles.
Well, no, because the introduction to the book and the last 50 pages of the book talk about solutions. It's actually, I like to think, a hopeful book, a book about remembering what unites us as opposed to what divides us, focusing on the commitments that prior generations have made to defending democracy. And I hope pointing out how important it is that we preserve our institutions like democracy and public safety and the rule of law. So I'm hopeful that what I've done in this book is to help people identify some of these tactics so that they can understand them and avoid being manipulated by them. And then I offer solutions, some that are at the governmental level, like regulating social media and removing dark money from politics. But many of them are at the individual level, like media literacy and giving people some tips for how they can spot false claims when they read them online. But, you know, in the end, I say that if we are going to survive as a democracy, we have to recommit ourselves to truth. So what I'm really hoping to do with this book is to just spark a national conversation about the importance of truth.
Okay, now in the section where you start with the solutions, which you title, We Alone Can Fix It, Proposed Solutions, you have the statement, quote, the tandem threats of authoritarianism and disinformation can seem overwhelming, but we as a nation have solved big problems before. And then you say, we can reduce disinformation from the supply side. We can regulate online publishers like other industries, you know, make them suable for defamation, for example. We can prohibit anonymous users and bots. We can require disclosure of funding sources. Who's the dark money here? We can regulate algorithms. We can end SponCon, fake news stories that are sponsored by advertisers and not disclosed on television and radio. We can subsidize paywalls. We can strengthen local journalism. I'm big on that. We can restore equal time in the fairness doctrine that was rejected under Reagan and the FCC. We can create a code of ethics for social media platforms. We can reduce disinformation from the demand side. You know, the consumer can say, hey, this is nonsense, can reject it. We can promote civic engagement, use and improve online tools, mitigate the harms to democracy, reform campaign finance, protect election machinery, and mitigate the harms to public safety and national security. Now, some of these are self-enforcing by civic awareness and civic response. Some of them might be headed off if we taught civics seriously in our elementary and high school, and connected it to civic experience in the community under adult guidance. But most of them require Congress, like to restore the ban on assault weapons, police violent content online, and so forth. But you don't focus on the Congress. Can you tell our listeners what they have to do to get all these recommendations moving by becoming a force on Congress, becoming what we call a Capitol Hill citizen, which is the title of our new newspaper on Congress, which I'd be happy to send you copies of?
Yeah, I'd love to see it. Well, I think that many of these solutions, not all of them, but many of them do require acts of Congress, you know, amending Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, you know, regulating social media, adjusting the way campaign finance laws work. All of those will require acts of Congress. And so to that extent, you know, we the people hold that power by electing members of Congress who will commit themselves to the truth. We're in dire circumstances here with some members of one party refusing to commit themselves to truth. When people like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger tried to focus on truth, they were purged from their party. And so I think it's going to take some political courage to do that. But if we can elect honorable members of Congress from both parties who are committed to truth, then I think we could begin to make some progress on adjusting some of these laws, which I think would mitigate the harms of disinformation. And I think what mostly we need to do is to demand that we commit ourselves to truth.
Well, you know, you make good points. The Republicans are the leaders in disinformation in Congress on climate violence, on the IRS budget, and what the IRS plans to do with an expanding budget to minimize the Republicans aiding and abetting mass tax evasion by the super rich and corporations. But I've noticed there are some areas where there isn't any disinformation because they're democracy deserts. And corporate crime and corporate welfare. Do you see disinformation on that?
Absolutely, Ralph. That's certainly the case. As a prosecutor prosecuting cases of corporate fraud, I saw the ways that corporations are really benefited in our legal system. I mean, one is the penalties for white-collar crime pale in comparison to the street crimes that are committed by ordinary people. So that's one area where there is a disparity. But I also think that one of the things we have seen in recent years is this effort by some politicians to drive a wedge between white citizens and lower wealth minority citizens. And that is because if you can keep them apart from each other, you can keep whites on your side as a voting bloc, and they will even vote on issues that are against their own self-interest if you can convince them that the real danger to America is immigrants or minorities or the LGBTQ community, and that those are the real threats. And if the politician is going to give corporate tax cuts and tax cuts for the wealthy that makes you less well off financially, then you'll be willing to overlook that because they've convinced you that the real threat is something else. So I do think that there is disinformation out there that is designed to benefit the haves over the have-nots.
What do you think law schools should be doing about this?
I hope opening our eyes to our students, helping them understand how there are disparities that exist in the system, that people will work to manipulate others to preserve their power or to gain power, but that the rule of law is a great tool for achieving equal justice under law.
Any last comments to our listeners that I haven't asked you about you'd like to end with?
I would just say that ourselves even to engage in our ends. The ends can never justify. We're going to